Hello, listeners, and welcome back to the Percy Jackson Son of Poseidon podcast. This is episode 8, part 2 of my review for the Titan's Curse. So we left off with Percy finally joining the quest, meeting up with Thalia and Zoe and Grover and Bianca at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. So then the group hop on a train and they meet a hobo, which is really Apollo in disguise. And Apollo talks to Percy and he says that, you know, he can't directly help them with the quest, but he wants Percy to look out for his sister, Artemis. And it's kind of cool seeing Apollo kind of come back again. I like the Apollo character. And then he kind of is the one that, you know, helped them with the train and stuff. So then the group ends up stopping off in an old ski town in New Mexico, where they are attacked by the skeleton warriors again. So Grover uses his reed pipes to call for help. So Grover has been practicing his pipes and, you know, casting, you know, nature spells and stuff. And so, you know, he's convinced that Pan, you know, the satyr god of nature, has sent them this giant boar called the Eurymanthian boar. And so, and you know, at first they're kind of fighting the boar and the skeleton warriors. But then Percy, you know, he learns that Thalia is afraid of heights, which is kind of ironic because her father Zeus is the god of the sky. As they kind of go over this bridge to escape the skeleton warriors. So then they get on the boar and they ride the boar, because it's a large boar, fits all of them, as far as they can, and they hop off in Arizona. There they run into Ares, the god of war, who does not have a good track record with Percy, but Ares instructs Percy to stay behind and talk to Aphrodite, the goddess of beauty and love. And Aphrodite tells Percy that, you know, he needs to focus on saving Annabeth. And that she says it's kind of a beautiful love story for the two of them. And Percy, you know, kind of is like, oh, we're not in love. And he's really, you know, shy and embarrassed by that, which is kind of cute. It's a reaction, you know, a 13, 14-year-old boy would have. And Percy kind of just says that, you know, he admits, you know, he doesn't want Annabeth to go join the hunters. And he's, you know, he doesn't say why, but it's, you know, it's because, you know, they like each other and stuff. So, you know, Percy insists it's not love, it's just friendship. But I'm not really sure why we get this interruption with Aphrodite here. It doesn't really add anything to the overall plot of the story. She doesn't really come back. It doesn't really add any extra motivation to Percy wanting to save Annabeth, and he doesn't bring it up, at least in this book. So I'm not really sure why we have this little detour talk here with Aphrodite. Maybe it'll come in the future books, but it's kind of cool to meet a new god or goddess, so that is cool. And then we also learn that there is something off about Bianca, because she mentions that she and Nico lived in Washington, D.C. when they were younger, but that there were no subway trains when they lived there, and it wasn't until they came back last year that she realized that there was the subway. So, and then also, when Zoe mentions going to Las Vegas, Percy warns them about it, and Bianca says that she spent some time there. So, we know something's up with Bianca, and it's revealed that Bianca and Nico did stay in the Lotus Hotel, which, obviously, we know Percy, Annabeth, and Grover stayed in the first book. And so, time works differently in the Lotus Hotel. So, they actually went in to the Lotus Hotel when Franklin Roosevelt was the president, and they've been there for like 70 years until somebody came to get them out just a year or two ago. So it is kind of suspicious that they were sent into the hotel and somebody came to grab them out of the casino. And it's revealed at the end of the book, but I think it's, you know, kind of suspicious. It adds a little bit of a mystery to it because of something that we do learn at the end of the book. And so I kind of do like this sort of tease of, you know, what's going on with Bianca and Nico D'Angelo. So that's kind of cool. And then the group wind up in the junkyard of Hephaestus, which Aphrodite did warn them about, because they are married. And Percy was told by Aphrodite not to take anything, but then the group is attacked by Talos, a junkyard monster, because Bianca did steal something. She stole a little figurine statue from that game that her brother plays. So the monster kind of comes after him. They get the idea to lure the monster near the power lines, and Bianca tries to take the monster out on her own. And she ends up going inside the monster to control it, to move it towards the power lines, and it fries the monster, causing him to collapse. And they try to search for Bianca, but they can't find her, so presumably she is dead. And just like the prophecy said, one shall be lost in the land without rain, which is Arizona, because it's a desert. So we do lose Bianca on this journey, and I'm not really sure if this gets referenced again in the other books, or if we find out what actually happened to her. I'm not really sure about that. But we lose Bianca on this journey so far, which is kind of sad, because she was kind of, again, a little bit of an interesting character. She had just joined the Hunters. I think we could have done maybe a little bit more with Bianca than get rid of her right away, especially since we kind of do something similar with another character at the end of the book. But then the group ends up going up the Colorado River to the Hoover Dam with help from some river nereids. And at the Hoover Dam, they run into more skeleton warriors, and Percy escapes with the help of a mortal girl, Rachel Elizabeth Dare, who can see through the mist, which is kind of interesting. And I'm not sure if there is something more important going on with Rachel Elizabeth Dare. I don't remember if she comes back or not, or if it's explained why she can see through the mist. Is she, you know, the daughter of a half-blood or something? Or does she have that in her veins? I don't know. But she's kind of a cool character for this brief little interaction she gets with Percy. And, you know, I did have a vague memory of going to the Hoover Dam. I just thought it was in the second book, and it was with Annabeth. So it was kind of cool to see the way it actually plays out in this book. That's one of the things I like, is kind of not remembering the books very well, just having a vague memory. It's kind of like I'm rediscovering them all over again. So that's kind of fun. And then Thalia then asks Zeus, her father, for help with these giant metal angel statues that are dedicated to him. And so the angel statues come to life, and they fly the kids off to San Francisco. And they drop them off at the pier. And then Percy is told he needs to speak with Nereus, who is a sea god, and the father of the Nereids and everything. And so Percy has to, he needs to ask Nereus a question. I think this is explained by Zoe. But in order to do so, he has to wrestle Nereus, and he only gets one question. And so, of course, Percy wants to ask where's Annabeth, but he needs to focus on the actual quest. And so he ends up capturing him. You know, being the son of Poseidon, Nereus tries to drown him, but he can't. And so Nereus, you know, Percy asks Nereus about the monster that Artemis was hunting as a sort of way to kind of figure out what's going on with Artemis. And so Nereus just kind of laughs and says, well, the monster's here. And he points to the water. And it's revealed that the serpent cow that we met earlier with the hippocampi that Percy rescued, who he's named Bessie, that is the monster that Artemis was hunting. And we also saw Bessie at the Hoover Dam as well. So it was following Percy, or is following Percy. And so Zoe kind of explains a little bit about Bessie, the serpent cow, just called in Ophiotaurus. So, and Zoe knows a little bit about the Ophiotaurus because the Ophiotaurus played a role during the Titan War, and now it's reemerged 3,000 years later, and it's said to be what causes the fall of Olympus, because the prophecy says that a half-blood needs to sacrifice Bessie the serpent cow. And so then we get Dr. Thorne, who shows up, and he tries to recruit Thalia and tells her to kill Bessie, claiming she's the one from the prophecy because she'll be a 16 in 2 days. Percy opens a portal, or not a portal, but one of those iris messages to Camp Half-Blood, and talks to Dionysus, Mr. D. And he kind of doesn't want to really help them, and kind of just kind of casually waves them off. But then he actually does help them get rid of Dr. Thorne. And for a brief second, he calls Percy by his actual name, Percy Jackson, and then immediately denies that he did. So it's a fun little scene, kind of a way to incorporate Dionysus to show that he's not on Percy's side, but he's also not a complete bad guy either. He's just kind of a jerk in general. And so then Zoe decides to go visit Annabeth's father, who had just moved to San Francisco, to get their help, while Grover and Bessie, the Serpent Cow, leave to go back to New York, because Grover can talk to Bessie the Serpent Cow, the Ophiotaurus. And so now we're left with Thalia, Zoe, and Percy, and they go to meet Annabeth's father, Dr. Chase, and we also briefly meet her stepmom, who, you know, they don't come off as bad as Annabeth had said they were, and maybe they've changed over the years, or maybe that's just Annabeth's recollection because she's a child. But they don't come off that bad. And Dr. Chase is a battle strategy professor. And so that makes sense why he and Athena, the goddess of war, got together and had Annabeth. And why she's so smart. And so they tell Dr. Chase that Annabeth's in trouble. And he gives them their car so that they can drive to Mount Tamalpais. Tamalpais? Tamalpais. Tamalpais. Mount Tam. Zoe wants to go there because it's the Garden of Hesperides. And Zoe is the daughter of Hesperus, so they decide to go there, but on their way, the car was hit by a lightning bolt, and Thalia assumes that it's Zeus, because of the prophecy, one will perish by the hand of a parent, but Percy tries to tell her, no, it's not Zeus trying to kill you, it's actually Kronos. And so they get to the Garden of Hesperides. Zoe is kind of an outcast, because she is now, you know, she turned her back on them, and she's a hunter now. And she's kind of originally turned away by her sisters. But then she awakens the dragon Laden. And so Percy and Thalia and Zoe fight the dragon. And Percy and Thalia escaped unharmed. But Zoe does get injured. But then they climb their way up to the mountain and discover the ruins of Mount Othrys. And Zoe explains that this is bad because Mount Othrys was the base where the Titans were during the Titan War between the gods and the Titans, and it's also the place where Atlas holds up the sky. So the fact that it's on this mountain, where they know Artemis to be, is a bad sign. So it's revealed that Artemis is now holding up the sky in place of Atlas, and that's what he, I believe, needed her for. And so, and this is what Percy's kind of saw in his dream. And then we discover that the general of Kronos' army is Atlas himself. And he is also the father of Zoe and the other Hesperides. And so this was a reveal I didn't see coming because I did not remember Atlas. I didn't remember any of this ending of the book. And I didn't remember the prophecy and Artemis holding up the sky and any of that. So this was kind of a fun twist and reveal for me. And so I really enjoyed this. And then Luke is also there. He's holding Annabeth hostage. So Percy, Zoe, and Thalia decide to fight them. And also the ship that they were on from the last, they're sending warriors from the ship over to them and stuff. And so it's this whole big battle thing going on. Percy tries to go after Atlas, but something that Ares said in the first book sticks out to him, where he says something about his weapon Riptide will fail him when he needs it the most. So Percy decides to switch place with Artemis, and he holds up the sky so that she can go fight Atlas with Zoe. And so Percy is able to hold it up temporarily, struggles, obviously, because he's only half-blood. And Zoe ends up getting injured, and when Atlas comes after Percy kind of tricks him a little bit. He makes a quick move, slides out from under, and tricks Atlas to going back into his position of holding up the sky. So it's kind of, Percy does a lot of these kind of like clever things along the way, so he's not like book smart like Annabeth, but he can think on his feet really quick, and I like that. They've consistently shown that ability in Percy. And so now Atlas is stuck again, and that's actually the Titan's Curse that the book is named after, and that was referenced in the prophecy. The Titan's Curse is of holding up the sky, because Atlas is a Titan. And so the pole prophecy has come together. Titan's Curse, one must withstand, was meant for Percy to withstand holding up the sky. Bianca died in the land without rain, and Zoe falls at the hand of her father. And so we get the whole prophecy kind of wraps up here at the end. And Zoe kind of always knew that she was the one that was going to end up perishing at the hand of a parent, but she still went on the quest anyway, because that's how much Artemis means to her. And so I kind of like that as a character arc for Zoe. She also kind of admits that not all men are terrible, and she kind of gives credit to Percy for being a hero and everything. And so it's kind of a good way to wrap up the Zoe character. But again, we've lost another cool character. And Thalia ends up sending Luke over a cliff, which we are presumed that he's dead, but we find out he's not. And Dr. Chase flies in on an airplane to take out the rest of the army that was working their way up the mountain and to rescue Annabeth, of course. And then Artemis says a spell and turns Zoe's golden ashes into a star constellation in the sky, which is kind of cool because she's the goddess of the moon and the hunt. And so it's kind of, I don't know if I like Dr. Chase coming in with the airplane at the end. That's a little too Deus Ex Machina for me. But it is kind of, it follows Annabeth's storyline of her dealing with her father. And so it kind of brings that together a little bit better that he came to her rescue. But she still decides to go back to New York. And so, you know, it's Annabeth, you know, says to Percy that Luke is still alive. And then Blackjack, the Pegasus horse, and two other Pegasi come to rescue Percy, Annabeth, and Thalia. And they fly them back to Mount Olympus. And so the three of them go to Mount Olympus for the winter solstice meeting, where Artemis has already gone off to also. And they find that Grover and Bessie are already there. And Artemis congratulates them as heroes for saving the day, while Ares, Dionysus, and Athena agree that Percy and Thalia are just too powerful to be kept alive, and they should be killed. Which is kind of dark for a children's book, but the point that they make is in line with what we've been saying all along, is that the prophecy of one of the children of the Big Three controlling Olympus, and that children of the Big Three are just too powerful in general. So, you understand where they're coming from. Ares is a little bit more just on the bitter side that Percy, he just doesn't like Percy personally. Dionysus doesn't really care, but he understands, Athena's point. And Athena is just the goddess of wisdom, so logically to her it means get rid of them. And the Olympians all want to kill off Bessie, the Ophiotaurus, because it's too risky to have it around because of the prophecy. But Percy convinces them not to kill Bessie. And Poseidon offers to take care of the Ophiotaurus and protect it. So we don't kill Bessie, that's nice. And I'm not sure if we do get Bessie in the next couple books or not, or how that all plays in to the prophecy as we go to the end of the book. So maybe we'll see if Bessie returns. And then Artemis offers Thalia to replace Zoe as her lieutenant of the hunters. And Thalia accepts the offer and takes the oath of the hunters of Artemis, because that means that she will never turn 16, meaning that the prophecy cannot be about her. So Thalia has decided to take the prophecy into her own hands, which is the whole reason why Luke needed the Golden Fleece to bring Thalia back, is because he wanted her to use her to control the prophecy. But now she's kind of flipped it, and so now she can't be the one in the prophecy because she'll never turn 16 anymore. She'll always be the same age because now she's part of the hunters. And this is also something that I had gotten confused about, because I didn't remember Bianca, but I did remember that Thalia became a hunter. I just thought it was at the beginning of the book when Bianca did it. I thought that it was Thalia, but it wasn't. So it's kind of interesting that it comes here at the end. But also, like Bianca, we're kind of just, introduced, and Zoe, we're introduced to these cool female characters, and then they're gone by the end of the book. And I know we have Annabeth still, but I really liked Bianca, Zoe, and I really liked Thalia and her sort of relationship with Percy, both being children of one of the Big Three. Thought we could have done a lot more with Thalia as a character, and I'm not sure if we get much of her in the next two books or not. And then Percy has a talk with Poseidon, and Poseidon warns Percy to be careful about Kronos, and that Luke is indeed still alive. So Luke is alive. And then Athena talks to Percy, letting him know that she does not approve of his friendship with Annabeth, like a spoken like a mom, and but that she still thinks that he is dangerous because he is a child of the Big Three. And so it's kind of interesting. Again, we're introduced to more gods on Mount Olympus, which is cool. And we get more conversation with Percy and Poseidon, which is nice, because in the first book we didn't really get much and he came off really cold. Here he comes off a little bit more concerned for Percy, just trying to warn him and wants to help him, but he knows how risky this is, that Percy is the son of one of the Big Three and what the prophecy could do. So I do like that. And then Percy asks Annabeth to dance, which is cute, because they started dancing at the beginning of the book. And it's a nice little scene, and, you know, it's really cute, and it's really, you know, it's obvious they like each other and everything. It's really, you know, teenagers being teenagers and awkward and stuff. And he does say, it's confirmed that Percy is 14 by the end of this book. So in the first book, I believe he had just turned 12. So it's been about 2 years since the beginning of that first book or so. I think he did just turn 12, something like that. Or maybe he just turned 13, I'm not sure. But so, you know, Percy has 2 more years before he turns 16. So the prophecy could still be about him. And then we go back to Camp Half-Blood, and Percy has to tell Nico about his sister Bianca, which of course upsets Nico because Nico wanted Percy to protect Bianca. And all of a sudden, the Skeleton Warriors come back to camp, and Nico is enraged at Percy, and he hates him, and he's yelling at him. And then Nico opens up the ground and swallows the Skeleton Warriors whole, and, you know, before he runs away. And then Percy notices the figurine that Bianca had given Nico, which was actually a figurine they had said that it was the only one he didn't have, and it was the god Hades. And so Percy kind of puts two and two together, and it's revealed that Nico and Bianca are the children of Hades. But Hades didn't break the oath because he technically had them before the oath was made during World War II. But after the oath was made, he hid them away, or somebody hid them away at the Lotus Hotel, for decades. But we still don't know who got them out. And so now the prophecy could be about Nico. So now we have another player into the prophecy. So we thought it was Thalia. Now we think it might be Nico instead of Percy. And so, you know, and Nico also mentions that he knows that his sister is dead. Because Hades is the god of the underworld and the dead. And Nico says he had a dream about it. But we don't really know what the dream was about. And then Grover comes in running, and he says that, you know, he heard the voice of the long-lost god of the wild Pan. And then that's kind of where the book ends. Grover, you know, his dream was to be the satyr that finally finds Pan. And earlier in the book, you know, he was convinced that Pan had helped them with the giant boar. And so he drank a bunch of coffee and meditated in hopes of communicating with Pan. And apparently it paid off because he says he heard his voice. And so we'll find out more in the next book. And that kind of concludes Grover's kind of overarching storyline that we've had since the beginning of the book, the first series, the first book, of him wanting the searcher's license and wanting to go out and find Pan. And so I like that we're kind of continuing Grover's arc. We don't get a whole lot of Annabeth in this, but we kind of also continue her arc with her father. We get some great reveals here. Percy, Annabeth, and Grover decide not to tell Chiron about Nico. I don't know why. That's always something that kind of bothers me in fiction, is storytelling. Children, for some reason, don't think the adults need important information like this, and usually it comes back to bite them in the butt. So it's a little bit of a trope, but again, they are kids, and I don't really understand the reasoning for not telling Chiron. I think Chiron should know. But so it's a little twist at the end here with Nico being revealed to be the son of Hades. So that's kind of how the book wraps up. And that kind of concludes this episode, wrapping up the second half of the book. In part 3, we'll go over my thoughts of the book as a whole, and the characters and story arcs and everything. But until next time, thank you all for listening. This has been the Percy Jack, Son of Poseidon podcast.